Blog Talk Radio.
I don't know nothing about that. All I know is that somebody is going to get their ass whooped over this thing.
Okay. Since I don't normally catch that beginning intro, I think I'm on. So I'm going to start talking like I'm on. And I'm just going to go. Because there's no time like the present. The past is history, the future is a mystery, and that's why right now is a gift called the present. So hopefully we're going, and I'll just start talking a little bit and get into a little bit of a groove if I can, if there is such a thing. And it will get me acquainted with this system here. It's really cool to be able to see it from this side, and it's actually a neat setup. I think everybody should be able to take advantage of this. If there's anybody else out there that would want to, it would be such a shame not to use it. It's really cool. It was really, really easy if I did it right. And I think that I did. It's really something. And, you know, I don't remember if I talked about this on the air or not, but there's a place called Toastmasters where you can learn how to be a public speaker. That's not where I went. As a matter of fact, I spoke in some crazy places that, you know, housed maybe 100, 150, 200 people. So I know what it looks like looking out at that many people. And that's a lot of people to fit into a room and to talk in front of. But to think that when you go on air and with the technology that we have to be able to do shows like this, you know, whether they're pre-recorded, whether they're live, whatever the format is, you could get in front of, in a phone call, in one or being the person, you know, talking. You could get to speak in front of more people than you could probably get up in front of in your whole lifetime or, you know, ever be in front of in your entire lifetime. It really is truly amazing. And the thing that blows people's minds when you do a website is if you start a website, it can be an obscure one. My dad started a website for a like a social site for people that went on trips and things. And I said to him, you know, a friend of mine has a website from YouTube, and he put this thing in the corner that everybody sees when they log on. And it was like a little rotating globe. And every time, you know, a day or 2 days would go by, it would show all the hits around the world of the people that had, you know, seen the site, had visited the site. And I said, you know, you'll see how fast this thing's going to light up because the internet is worldwide. 24/7, and you wouldn't believe how many people are somehow come across, whether by accident or on purpose, will come across your content. So once you do see that little globe lit up, you know, like a Christmas tree, and after maybe 2 weeks, he had so many hits. I think it was in the 500,000 range, at least. It was maybe even higher. A lot of the stuff was spam, unfortunately, because if you set up a website like that where it's, you know, it's open to that sort of stuff, then you do get spammed. But, you know, the point is that we have the technology to create something special, do something special to, it's almost incumbent on us to if we have something important to say, or even if it's just an important opinion or something to share, because it's so radically different than before. It just leaps and bounds from 2008 or 2009 when a friend of mine was using Blog Talk. It's changed so much just since then that it's almost incumbent upon us to use it and to take advantage of it and to, you know, maybe just share some experiences, some life experiences. You know, it doesn't always have to be, you know, super intrigue and super conspiratorial or whatever you're going to call this sort of stuff that we do. In fact, I had a hard time coming up with the tags for the show, so I tried to make them as broad as possible. So if it brought in anybody in the future or not, that, you know, said, hey, he said news, politics, I think I said celebrities, movies, I forget. I made it pretty broad. And then I said, in the esoteric world we all inhabit. Because that is what we live in, whether we understand it, acknowledge it, or, you know, look far, that far into this sort of stuff. But once you do see this stuff, it's sort of a double-edged sword. Once you see it, you know, when you're at the beginning, it's mysterious and it's interesting, and you know, you get kind of a rush when you learn the new information and you say, wow, I want to tell people. And then sometimes you get kind of a bad reaction when you tell the way you tell it and how you tell it, this stuff. But when you start to learn this stuff, it's almost like that scene in The Matrix where he gives them the first few programs to set him up. And he says, well, let's skip the boring ones and go straight to the, you know, the Kung Fu programming and the jujitsu programming. And he says, did you like that? And Keanu Reeves kind of makes this face like, you know, like he just took a hit of something that went straight to his brain. And he goes, hell yes. Hell yes. Like more. And he goes, hey, Mikey, I think he likes it. So the place where we're at, we had Elon Musk. I always forget his name. We had Elon Musk announce the Neuralink. We have the Internet of Things. We have all kinds of stuff, you know, coming out of Intel with Israel. We had Bibi Netanyahu saying that cyber is the real domain of power. Because that's it. That's the future. That's the information war. The cyber shaman, as it was Bill Hicks, Alex Jones, who said, you know, and that's a weird one, the whole Bill Hicks, Alex Jones connection, but there were some really interesting videos put together with these, even better than the older ones, where one of them's called Like Jazz, and it's almost like they're having an inside joke. Whether the guy died or not, there's some sort of inside joke that they're having. And if you read the little, it must have been either a treatment or a manifesto that Bill Hicks wrote. He said, I'm not a comedian. He said, I fooled you guys. I think it's on his Facebook page. His posthumous, well, he was never, he was not alive long enough for Facebook. He died way before that. So his Facebook page must have been set up, you know, not too long ago. And it says, I fooled you all. I was a shaman. And I came in the form of a comedian. And then he wrote a letter of a show that he wanted to do in conjunction with the BBC. And he said he wanted to play a character, which was like a right-wing radio host from hell, in the vein of like a Rush Limbaugh. And they had come up with them being the, I believe it was the Aquino, Paul Valley crowd. And it was part of the Disinfo Network, which is what they call themselves, Metzger's Disinfo Network. And they had this idea of the cyber shaman. Now, I think that Jones has been eclipsed by everyone's favorite, I guess, comedian is where he came out of, Joe Rogan. And I personally don't like Joe Rogan because I think that he placates his guests. I think that he condescends his audience because he's so wishy-washy, and whoever the guest is that's on, he doesn't challenge them. He goes along with them. And then I've seen him like change his views on different things. And then he does shill for things that are being pushed by this group. And one of them is the universal basic income. Now, when would you administer universal basic income? You would do that the step forward from, see, it was the Department of Agriculture that set up the, and this was a socialistic type of a setup, but, well, we could debate it on a different day, but the EBT was, it made a jump from SNAP, and the Department of Agriculture was set up under Lincoln. And what happened was, if you have an EBT card or you had food stamps, what happened was that that's the chip they're talking about shutting off, and that's the universal basic income. The jump from one to one is basically, how can we pay a bunch of people that will not accept, you know, the increasingly crappier jobs, as George Carlin said. See, they use these comedians for multiple purposes. They get them to talk about things that people can then laugh at. I said this with Bill about how George Carlin's special, I think the last two that he did, one was It's Bullshit and It's Bad for You, which sounds like a Bill Cooper episode. And the other one was when he was in the graveyard walking around in all black. And his father had been in advertising. So he came out with an interesting intellectual approach. I think he was a left-leaning person, if you put him on the political scale. And basically what he said was that there was a big club, you weren't in it, and that people were going to have to be just smart enough to accept the increasingly shittier jobs with the pensions that were disappearing when you went to go collect them, the Social Security that they were coming to take from you, which, you know, was dubious from the beginning, and a system that threw these people overboard 30 years ago. And at the end he said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. He said, you and I are not in the big club. So that's debatable whether or not he was. He probably was. I know that his background was supposedly, I think his father was a advertising, you know, in advertising. In advertising, the key words are you need, you want, you get. Man, I really hope this is being recorded, as I feel really... really funny talking into the ether again. I'm back talking into the ether again. So George Carlin, comedians and their roles in this whole thing is not to be taken lightly. What they do is they relieve tension. They have agendas. Their jokes are, they ask them to, I think it was Owen Benjamin, as a matter of fact, talked about this. And you know, no matter what the stance is with him, I think what he's doing is he's playing the middle. I know that he's connected through certain people behind the scenes, but he is sort of his own man. And what's happening is that I had a knock at the door. What's happening is that he's playing the middle because they're trying to get more sophisticated. They understand that people can see people like Alex Jones a mile away, and they really can't see Joe Rogan, though. I don't understand why. The guy that does his tech, Jamie, and there's a guy called Staggs, who's a Satanist that does his booking, and I think, you know, accept his agenda, but, you know, who's to say for sure? But he books his guests. And Jamie, you know, some people will say, hey, he's in there erasing the comments. So there are some people who, you know, understand that there's censorship, and that he's, if there's censorship, look, somebody's pushing an agenda. And speaking of censorship right now, there's a guy who, I like his stuff, I like his books, but I don't like the people he hangs out with. And he will do any show. And I've seen him on everything from like pet psychics to, you know, white nationalists to that Jewish guy that he got in the fight with that does the Jewish Christian, who kind of tries to bridge the gap, but then kind of stirred up a controversy when he had him on. Brown, I think his name was. Well, anyway, this guy, E. Michael Jones, has Culture Wars. Alex Jones has InfoWars. And he goes on every show, E. Michael Jones. And he's trying to, on the surface, which I think is good, and I think his books are good, they're big, giant, you know, like text manuals. His show, I mean, his books are Barren Metals, which is really good. I like the idea that capitalism is state-sponsored usury. I think too many people fall into that dialectic, you know, socialism is bad, communism is bad, so we have to do the, you know, the capitalist model. And I used to think that too, that it was the capitalist model, but it's actually more of the only real free market model, or the only, it's not even a model, the only true free market is really the black market or the unofficial market where people trade and barter. If you ever watch the show Alaskan Bush People, I'm trying to talk on the mic. Alaskan Bush People. Actually, I had a good microphone. Used to have this stuff. They barter for things. And that's the way it was done. And that's the way it was done even in the court. So let's say instead of going to war like the Southern Citizens, which was a setup movement, who are the other ones? The Sovereign Citizens and the, in Canada, they're the, what do they call themselves? They're Sovereign Citizens and Free Men on the Land. Yeah, both of those are movements where they want you to argue in a courtroom. Well, once you're arguing in the courtroom, you lost. What you want to do, where you have your actual court, and this is not legal advice, this is just common sense advice, you know, it's going to be outside on the street with the arresting officer or potentially arresting officer. But the whole thing is that, you know, if you're speeding down the road somewhere, and I don't mean at like 5 miles an hour, but if you're really speeding down the road and you get caught and hey, you did it, then what the idea was that you'd go in there and you would say, look, you know, you got me. You know, I was speeding. I broke the rules in this area. But I don't have the, you know, I don't have the cash, the USD to pay you. But could I work out a different arrangement to pay? Do you have some, I'm a mechanic. Are there some cars, you know, police cars that you need fixed? You know, or I wash cars or something or other. And you could actually find alternative ways to, you know, pay off these fines. But instead, they set a system up where the fines were just high enough and just low enough to where, you know, you would just try to pay them to keep your insurance from, you know, getting in trouble with your insurance company. And, you know, I can appreciate the I can appreciate that model of why we need, you know, police. I want my streets to be safe, and if and that comes back to one of the reasons why, if they're not revenue generating, that comes back to one of the reasons why I like Rogan stuff too. A guy got up in his face recently. It might not have been a recent video, but he posted the video. And he was down in, he was here in America. And I think it was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu sparring partner or somebody got up in his face and said, you know, you promote real negative things for kids, and you know, you encourage you know, the use of drugs, psychedelic drugs, psychoactive. He started arguing with him about what they were, and he said, well, no, I promote them to adults and that sort of thing, and you know, you encourage the use of marijuana and, you know, all those different things. And he argued with them back and forth. I think the guy was a Christian, so he was, you know, he was going at him pretty good. But he had kind of broken English, and he was having a hard time, you know, trying to express what he was saying. But he was right on in what he was saying. And Rogan was getting defensive. So the other thing, so that means that he has a conscience and that he is sort of pushing this stuff. He pushes the deprivation, the sleep deprivation tank. There's a whole thing behind that. Personally, I think that would be kind of creepy. Maybe for some people, it would be like a way to get away from things. But I don't know why you would want to add any DMT or anything like that to a imagine if you got locked in there or something. I don't know how the things work. I never personally jumped into one, but it would probably freak me out. So I remember him coming on Alex Jones's show, and he was promoting that back in, I think it was the early 08, maybe, around that time. And he was saying, man, Joe Rogan is on fire. So he was promoting him. And he promotes that. And now young people... You know, somebody asked, I like arm wrestling, and there was a guy, Monster Michael Todd, and he was answering questions on a live stream with his wife after this most recent, I think it was 504, and it's kind of neat, the history of arm wrestling, you know, how pretty much every culture used it, and they used it to determine who would be the general. And it makes more sense than two guys beating the hell out of each other in a ring or to wrestle each other over who gets to lead, because, you know, they'd be all beaten up. And here, if they arm wrestled, there's strategy, there's strength, and it would show who would want it more. And it would be just a better way to select it. So it's kind of macho, and it's also kind of neat in a historical way. But two guys barefisted, kicking each other, bouncing shin bones off each other's heads in an octagon is almost like degenerating down to, you know, gladiatorial bread and circus type things. Now, it was interesting because Mike Tyson said he was on a Mike Tyson says some interesting things sometimes. He has a double, by the way. People should look that up, and the double looks exactly like him, with the tattoo and everything, the face tattoo and everything. He said something interesting on a radio show, and he was explaining the history of boxing, the recent history. And he was saying that probably within the last, you know, 100 or so years. And he said what it was very similar to, if you've ever seen the movie Troy, where they call up Achilles, and he's asleep in his tent, and they, you know, there's two armies lined up on two opposing sides of the field, and they're going to go to battle, but they each pick a champion. And then that one guy, they say, look, we'll put our arms down, you put your arms down, you pick your best guy, we'll pick our best guy, and they'll go at it, and that way it'll save us a lot of bloodshed. Which, if you look at it from that angle, that makes more sense too. So after you pick the general with the arm wrestling, then you could pick the champion. And you know, I can see the roots of all that. So he was saying, like Tyson was saying, that that was exactly what they used to do. And that was what the whole boxing thing was, and why it has its roots in, well, it became fixed and things like that. It was almost like a gang type of a thing for territories. See, in the old days, the upper class were the Germans, and I believe the WASP elite, then in the middle were kind of like the politicians, the cops, and, you know, those kinds of jobs, were the Irish predominantly. And then it was the Italians and so on and so forth down the ladder. And what happened was that a good movie that shows it is Gangs of New York. And there's some they squeeze a lot of stuff into, Scorsese got to squeeze a lot of stuff into that movie, where he showed the scenes where guys had just gotten off a boat, and I just imagine this, because they used to dump guys off in Canada with no clothes, and they just freeze to death after traversing the Atlantic Ocean just to get over here. And, you know, imagine how horrible it would be in close quarters trying to get over here. Well, in this movie, there's a scene where these guys are coming over from Ireland, and right as they get off the boat, they're giving them a uniform and enrolling them in the Union to fight for the North. So right as they get off the boat, they are immediately enlisted and conscripted into, not even as mercenaries, just, you know, just out of, you know, just they just directed them down the line. If you've seen the movie, you've seen that part. Another thing he gets away with telling you in that movie, too, is there's a scene where the people are starting to, there's some grumblings and, you know, people are starting to get angry and upset about things. So one of the guys says, hang four people tomorrow. And these people go to the gallows so nonchalantly. This one guy is just making, you know, small talk on the way, walking up to the gallows, and he's saying hi to his son, and his son's like, hey, Dad, and he's like, hey, son, and he's like, here, hold my things, and take this, and, you know, and they're just, their lives were so expendable, you know, it was really, and the other thing that he got away with in that movie, he got away with talking about how the natives, meaning the Irish who had been here for a couple of generations, they called themselves the Natives, and it was played by Daniel Day-Lewis's side, the butcher. He was an actual butcher. And then there was the priest played by Liam Neeson, who represented the new wave of immigrants coming in. And they have a big fight at the beginning, this real big bloody fight. It was a little bit overdone because one of the girls had like claws like Wolverine. And I don't know if they had claws like Wolverine. You know, they didn't retract or anything, but, you know, it was kind of like over the top with the weaponry. So they have this big gang fight at the beginning, and the priest was fighting. Liam Neeson, the priest, was fighting, and his son watched him get killed by the butcher. His son grew up to be the lead, Leonardo DiCaprio, who swore revenge. So he was going to get in with this guy when he got older and, you know, I don't know, sneak up and stab him or shoot him at the right day and the anniversary of the, I don't know how he was the son of the priest though. Maybe he was a choir boy or he was adopted or something, but it was something like that. So that movie in there, the reason they had such a beef with people coming over here was that, number one, the natives didn't like so many people coming over here. It was very crowded. It was New York City. And they were clashing a lot, and, you know, you had to, they were running to petty crime, like pickpocketing and stuff. And he said the Pope is influencing who they will vote for over here. So there was an argument over the King James Bible native Christians versus the recently immigrated, you know, fresh off the boat Irish who were on the Catholic side. And, you know, when do they ever talk about that stuff in movies, if ever? And I'm of two minds, as I was talking about E. Michael Jones earlier, about the Catholic Church. I think there does have to be a magisterium. I think there does have to be an authority on how to interpret the scripture. I think otherwise what happens is that you'll have a bunch of schisms and everybody trying to interpret it in their own way. You can use hermeneutics, and you can use exegete the passages, but there's sort of an agreed upon, there's a way that it's called the four senses is what they use, but there's sort of an agreed upon interpretation of what each scripture means. Now, once you go past that, if you want to do the stuff that Bill does and the stuff that I try to watch Bill do, because I don't think I'm as good at pulling stuff apart as he is, and he's really good at pattern, you know, looking at the patterns, the colors, the numbers, all that sort of stuff. He's just naturally good at that. And if you want to then go deep after, you find out what that agreed upon meaning is. Now, the Catholic Church does accept the Russian Orthodox Church, because I think they believe it has an apostolic tradition. So I think they're okay with that church. But all the other ones that came after the Martin Luther and the schism, there were so many thousands of different variations that Christianity is all over the place, and people have their own. A lot of people, this is important, because I saw this the other day. I was talking about this with Bill, and then I saw another guy. I forget what his last name is now. People know him. He's the Italian guy. He was talking about some of the same things. What they're doing with some of their interpretations of Christianity, and they're doing this for a reason. They wanted to make the guy that wrote the Encyclopedia Brown books was trying to create a universal one world language. And you can look it up. And they were also trying to work on a universal one world religion. And part of the way they do it is through mysticism. And it's kind of like an archetypes. That's why they have Jordan Peterson walking around talking about the Jungian archetypes and then applying them to the Bible. So you would say things like, basically the Jesus is the Son, and, you know, the astrotheology stuff. And the reason why they want to do that is if they can sell that idea to the 1 billion Christians that they count under the net of, the Vatican actually counts them as Christians, even if they're in a different subgroup or, you know, sect, I guess they would be called. They want to get them all, you know, together. And if they could get some of them who believe in the surface story and are all about the history and the traditions to understand, they push this idea. That's why Charles Manson knew the idea. If you watch the YouTube clip, you'll see him say, there's a Hispanic, Mexican Jesus, the Korean Jesus, or this Jesus. And he goes, and yeah, he's down in Mexico and he's doing good. And then he goes, it's the consciousness. That's what they're taught, that there's this Christ consciousness and it's inside of everybody. And basically, if you believe that, it sounds nice, then all religions are the same. So if I were to evangelize somebody, I would use these two examples. I have two for Judaism that I talked about before, which is the letters being the numbers and how complicated that would be for the Hebrew alphanumeric translation for the numbers to actually turn into the letters to tell a coherent story and then turn into the numbers and then still make sense and line up. It's hard to explain it on the over the, you know, without visual aid. But the second one for Judaism is also the mass sighting of God when he was in the cloud coming down from the mountain, and supposedly I think over 1 million people saw him all at the same time. That's their claim. And the one for Christianity that I think is the most compelling is the one that E. Michael Jones is pushing, and a lot of Christians know about it that aren't Catholics. They know the word logos, and logos is basically logic, and that there's this ordered universe, that everything's ordered and has a purpose and a reason, and that in the Gospel of John, it doesn't say in the Greek, in the beginning was the Word. It says in the beginning was Logos. And that makes way more sense, because what does in the beginning was the Word mean? Or even if that was some sort of translation, I don't think it means much to most people. So that was a profound ontological statement. And when you really grasp it, he made a good, compelling argument that if you wanted to go back, let's say, to paganism, which some people want to do, they want to re-embrace their roots in, you know, their families, you know, maybe their family for thousands of years, you know, practiced an ancient religion, or they followed Thor or something, you know, other than Christianity or Judaism or Islam. Those are the people of the book. But let's say they practiced one of those. The argument against it would be that once you discover logos, you really can't turn back to there's a million different gods, one of the rain, one of the sky, one of the, you know, seeds, one of the harvest, because it's like going backwards. So you could still, I guess, you know, pray to them and, you know, do that, but if you work it out philosophically, it's very compelling. The second one that I like to use came from an evangelical. I believe an evangelical. He's a Calvinist. I guess he's a preacher, pastor, and he tells this story about the three major religions and the reporter asking them each where they go when they die. And the first person he asks is the Muslim. And a reporter says to him, when you die, where will you go? And he says, to paradise. And the reporter says, why? And he says, because I pray, you know, X amount of times a day. Bill will like that one. I pray X amount of times a day. I give alms to the poor. I've made all the pilgrimages. I am a righteous man. So the guy says, okay, I understand that. Makes sense. And he asks the Jewish man, where will you go when you die? And he says, to heaven. And he says, why? And the guy says, I love the law. He says, I thrive on God's law and his mercy and so on and so forth. I, you know, make all of the, I go on to synagogue or to on all the holy days. You know, I am a righteous man. Then he asked the Christian, you know, what's going to happen to you when you die? He says, I'm going to go to heaven. And then he says, why? And the Christian says, I was born in sin, and in sin did my mother conceive me. And he said, I have no worth or merit to go to heaven. And the guy said, hold on, wait. The other two I understood. They said they do all these things. God is their debtor. God owes them when they die. And the Christian says, he said, they, I understand you. You're saying you're not worthy. You don't deserve it. Why should you go? And he says, because I'm going based on the worth and merit of another, Jesus Christ, my Lord, through the work he did on the cross. So the difference between the three religions was that, he said, and then he wrapped it up by saying, now which one of those three religions gives glory to man and which one gives glory to God? And to me, that was a great way of explaining it and summing it up. And it does make Christianity very unique. And C.S. Lewis, the same thing happened to him when he converted to Christianity. Tolkien was trying to convert him to Catholicism. He was, I think, an agnostic or an atheist. And what had happened was the other professors tried to trick him, and they put all these other, just like Zeitgeist, they put all these other Mithra and all these different gods on the board, on this chalkboard, and they said, what is the difference between all of these gods? Some of them died, some of them rose from the dead, some of them had a mother that had the same name, some of them, you know, they were trying to push the astrotheology thing out. And he looked at all of it, and he just said, the other ones don't have grace. Grace is what's missing. So there is a uniqueness in the logos, and to me, that would be a compelling way to end the debate if I was debating Richard Dawkins or one of these people. And I never understood why they were debating when I first saw these, because I think that they're debating philosophy with science, and science is a tool for measuring things. The scientific method, the real scientific method, is, you know, observable, testable data that's repeatable. You come up with a hypothesis, and then you see if you can repeat it. So, you know, they're arguing like apples and oranges. So why would they be doing that? Well, number one, if you look at Encyclopedia Dramatica, you'll see how much money the Daniel Dennett, I think it is, Squawkin' Dawkins, and Hitchens is gone, and I can't remember who the other one. I think Berlinski is an atheist who leans towards agnosticism, and he doesn't like their arguments. But it's basically a money thing, and I think Hitchens admitted that a few times. So I didn't find any of their stuff particularly compelling. In fact, Richard Dawkins is kind of dumb. In fact, I don't even know if he's really an evolutionary biologist or if he was just kind of given an honorary degree. He's not even good at arguing, you know, philosophy. He's not even good at arguing science. So, or explaining it as succinctly as I just tried to do, and I think I did. But I also said I'd cover the news here. So, obviously, the big news is the Epstein thing. A lot of people didn't know, I was shocked to find out, that Donald Trump not only was a protege of Roy Cohn, but he was a boy of Roy Cohn. There's a picture of him now that's surfacing where he's dressed up. Roy Cohn was famous for having guys dress up, and he was going to Studio 54. He was all mobbed up, and he would have these real decadent parties. And there was a book that hinted at one of the guys at one of the parties, because I think he liked tall blondes, as it said, was Donald Trump, and they hinted at it. And now a picture has surfaced that it actually is him, and he's in this crazy, you got to see the picture. He's in a, Google the picture and you'll find it. It was in Vanity Fair. And I think people are in shock. He actually looks like his son. They did a comparison with, what is it, Eric Trump, I think Donald Jr., and then Eric is the other one. And they did a comparison photo to see, you know, he was around the same age in the picture. And yeah, he was his mentor. And there's a documentary coming out about Roy Cohn saying, "I need Roy Cohn," which is a weird title. Just like there was a documentary called "Get Me Roger Stone," who was also tied in with Roy Cohn. And what happened was that this documentary, Roy Cohn said he wanted all of this information preserved and brought out at the right time, after his death, and he died in 1986. So, like I had talked about, I think more than a few times before, Donald Trump had been talking about the very first thing when he came on, I think it was Larry King, he said he could broker a peace deal. He might have been promoting the part of the deal at the time. Maybe that's what it was. It was definitely in the 80s. He was always, you know, they were always positioning him through Roy Cohn and Roger Stone is the connection with Nixon and the Birchers and all those people to get into politics. And he had a big name, you know, back then, you know, going way back. And the casinos, you know, are famously always tied to, I'm not saying his casinos, but casinos in general are a good place to wash money. And so are the other things. What does he do? The pageants, not just to wash money, but, you know, what do they do with beauty pageants? But there's something else that Trump was involved in where, you know, it was nothing good. So as much as I hate to side with, you know, the people in Hollywood, I think we were just like always screwed either way, you know, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So I can understand why people did vote for him. He was also using that software that picked up on things people were talking about. And, you know, it sorted through it. And he even used the speech patterns. He patterned his speech after Roy Cohn. And, you know, he's called him his mentor. So if you don't know who Roy Cohn is, watch the movie Angels in America. He was in the HUAC committee, the House Un-American Elect, he was doing the communist, that Hollywood calls him the communist witch hunts, but he was with Senator Joseph McCarthy doing the House Select Committee on Un-American Activities, I think was the whole title. And he was, you know, he was going after certain people really hard, and he was going after people for being homosexuals, which was kind of hypocritical because he was what they would probably call a fast mover, you know, like just threw caution to the wind. And in this movie that they made about him, because there was two they made about him, one was with James Woods, and the other one was Angels in America, which was a play. And then I think, and then they broke it into parts onto HBO. And in it, Meryl Streep plays Ethel Rosenberg, I think, and she comes back to haunt him. And he's so evil that he says, I'm scarier than you are. So he played this, it plays when he's dying in the hospital of AIDS. And, you know, all the way down to his last breath, you know, he's pretty much like this just, you know, indomitable evil guy. And, you know, he was, connected in some crazy way. So that's coming out. And he was a guy who compromised people. That was the connection, just like Epstein. And the FBI had been looking at Epstein for something like 20 years. He was a math teacher, I think he started out as. And someone gifted him a $77 million condo. And he was a hedge fund manager for like one guy. Nobody knew where he got his money from. First, he was a billionaire. Then he was unceremoniously trapped down to just a multimillionaire. And he was, somebody did a drone flyover of his island. So it has the temple there, which I'm sure they were using to pray and attend, you know, for Saturday services. I'm sure it was all about the holiness there, the holiest of holies. But he was obviously setting up a compromise. And there's a guy who, in a crowd, got up. And, you know, I normally don't like that sort of thing. I don't know why, but I did like this one. The guy got up in front of a crowd where Bill Clinton was talking to a reporter. And he said, 26 times, Bill, you flew on Epstein's plane and ditched your Secret Service and you went there. And all the people in the crowd, at first, they don't know what to say. I always like when people do that out loud because the security goes and runs up to them. First off, you know, what are they doing? They're just yelling. And I'm sure if they told them to just sit down and be quiet, or if they asked them politely, you know, maybe they'd stop. They always try to rush them out like with a don't tase me, bro guy. Well, what happened was, I mean, imagine that. Think about that. They tased that kid for asking a question about Skull and Bones to John Kerry. Just think about that for a minute. And while he was running for president. Well, the other one was this kid was saying 26 times, and the people in the crowd, in the audience that paid to go see Bill Clinton or whatever they did, they were saying, oh, be quiet. Oh, sit down. You know, basically, you know, shushing him. Now, if you don't know, even I know people who were fans of the Clintons, you know, and they acknowledge, just like the people acknowledged Kennedy, you know, got into some trouble that you couldn't drop a pencil around the guy. What is that a bridge too far for them? You know, is that just out of their reach? I can imagine. Maybe they didn't know who Epstein was. But even so, they had to shush this guy and call him a bum. And, you know, why didn't they say, answer the question, Mr. Clinton? You know, shut this guy up. You know, tell him off. Instead, you know, they acted like attack dogs. And I had seen this personally when I went to go see Newt Gingrich, because I was debating. No one had been doing this stuff before. This was back in 07, maybe 06. And I was like, should I do that? Should I start yelling things? But then I was like, you know what I'll do? I'll buy his book. I didn't buy the new book he wrote. I went and bought the cheapest soft cover I could find. He wrote some Civil War book. And I'll walk up and ask if I can shake his hand, get an autograph, and then I'll see if I can talk to the guy. And lo and behold, I got to talk to him. He had met with my family back in the day before he was deciding to go into politics. And I called my aunt and I said, do you remember Newt Gingrich? And she said, oh, yeah. She said, tell him I said hi. And she said, I remember back when he was still deciding on whether or not he was going to run as a liberal or a conservative. And which is a funny joke, because anybody that knows Newt Gingrich knows that he's like, he's one of these stalwart, you know, strong conservative leaders. And here, he was just looking at, when he was deciding on whether or not to run, which side he should actually run on, which would be more advantageous for him and his personal career. So that's how capricious it actually is. And that's not an exaggeration. Whether that story's true or not, which I'm pretty sure that it is, pretty like 99.9% sure that it is, that's pretty much how it goes. These people are, you know what to say. The guy came in well rehearsed when he walked in, and I saw these sycophantic people that were clasping their hands together and in tears going, won't you please run? I was at first freaked out to be around. You know, I considered myself sort of in the middle politically. And then all of a sudden, you know, I started talking to some of the people around, and they were nice. And they said, you know what, if you don't have a camera, we'll take the picture for you when you get up there, and we'll send you the picture. And I was like, you know what, these people are all right. I think they're just, you know, in certain areas, maybe they're a little too zealous, but, you know, they're okay. They were cool. And even old Newt answered a few questions afterwards, and he gave me a few strange looks because I asked him about the New World Order. This was back in 2006 or 7. I asked him about Federal Commission stuff, you know, all the hot conspiracy topics that were, you know, buzzwords back then. And I think, oh, I even asked him about the Bohemian Grove. Yeah, I asked him about the Bohemian Grove. And he saw me reaching down to my phone to try to turn it on to get a video. But this were, I had a flip phone back then, and it just wasn't easy to do like today. He didn't have a security. Nobody was trying to, you know, shut me up or, you know, hurry me along or move me out the door. It was totally different. I probably could have recorded him. But instead, I called into Alex Jones because I asked him, would you be a guest on a show? And Alex Jones was so excited to hear this story that he said, when you said that, what did he say? And he goes, I know what I, but he said, now we got one that can see, because he loves quoting They Live. So I told that story like the next day on that show. And I really did ask him that. I said, would you go on his show? Probably today he would have him on his show. He's probably had him on his show. And that's how different things have changed since then. That's how much things have changed since then. So, yeah, I was doing that was before We Are Change. And if they were doing things, they hadn't really uploaded them yet or had uploaded many, because otherwise I would have thought to do that. As a matter of fact, the idea to record it was just hitting me right then. So, but I have a friend of mine who runs into famous people so often that we literally come up with lines ahead of time, because he just, for some reason, is a magnet for famous people. He either waits tables on them, or he bumps into them at the supermarket, I'm not joking, or he walks his dog and runs into him, or because Bill said, oh, you've met everybody. No, this guy's met everybody. And he does it like Forrest Gump, and it's not planned. He just is like a magnet for, you know, varying degrees of famous people. Everybody from that guy from the guy that was in True Romance that said, all I have is Floyd. He's kind of goofy. He played Remy in Higher Learning. Mike Richards? No, not Mike Richards. That's the Kramer guy. But he met him walking his dog. He met Kevin Smith at the grocery store. And Kevin Smith was very nice and polite. This was before he had his heart attack and became vegan and lost all that weight. That new movie, they're remaking, Jay and Silent Bob, kind of on the fence about. They both look like the years have not been kind. And he met him. He said he was really cool. So I said, hey, man, well, what did you ask him? Because I bump into these guys like at the courthouse. I bumped into Vanilla Ice the day of or the day before September 11th. Yeah, I think it was the day before. So I know where he was during September 11th. He was registering, I think, as a felon. But he was in trouble. He was at the courthouse. And he was so cool. He talked for 3 hours. Now, I knew to ask some, you know, I'll actually maybe end with this story. I had read his book when I was a kid. I found it at Publix, and somehow it got put in our grocery cart. I'm not joking. And I flipped through it. I read it in like an hour or two. It was a little thin book. It was like a promotional thing. And in it, it said he used to do motocross, and he had a scar in his knee. So when I was talking to him, I said, hey, I know where you got that scar on your knee. And he goes, and then I told him. And he said, how did you know that? And I said, oh, I read that book. And he goes, you read that? And he was so taken back by the fact that I had found this book, read it, and remembered that he goes, I want you to come down to the motocross. I still do that down here in, I'll just say South Florida. And he said he still hung out with Lenny Kravitz, I think. Uh-oh. All right, we got 90 seconds to wrap up. I don't know if I should keep talking or say goodnight. I hope you guys got something out of this and it was informative. I didn't want to just go over the stuff that everybody goes over. Maybe I'll keep talking past the 90 seconds just to see what happens. Ooh, I wonder what will happen. And hopefully it recorded and hopefully I was cogent. Okay, take care. God bless and take care of yourselves. Good night and good luck. Bye bye. Ba-dum-bum-ba-dum-bum. I feel like Agent Smith. Is it over? Maybe I have to end it. Well, hell, if it'll keep recording, maybe let's talk a little bit. I really don't know what to do. If I keep talking a little longer or what? I feel a little bit lonely here by myself. I didn't hit that I could have a little harder. Now that I know how to do this, I'll be more comfortable. The problem is only, I guess if this is still recording, the problem is really just picking out a good time for people to listen, and you know, that suits you know, the fam, the family, because I had to move the computer at the last minute. This is behind the scenes special information for members only. I really don't know what button to push. I think I have to end the episode. But hopefully you guys enjoyed it and I wasn't too boring. And if I had time, this was all about just learning how to set it up. If I had time to prep it ahead of time, I could do a good episode. I could do an outline, maybe do one topic and jump around a little bit. Because one thing I learned in NAMM, the one thing I learned in NAMM is if a plane gets too that's the best line of the Big Lebowski. He's finally gonna admit what he finally learned in NAMM, and then he gets cut off. If a plane gets too, I think it's complicated, it goes awry. But yeah, basically if I can have a little bit of time to prep, which is what I wanted to do 4 years ago with my show. I just wanted them to be good, guys. That's all. I wanted to have good topics and an occasional guest. I was doing all guests. And make it worth the time because, you know, this is an amazing, important medium of mass communication. And it is a shame to just waste it if it's, you know, unlimited calling time and all that sort of stuff, all that fun stuff. It has all the bells and whistles. It's like, it would be a crying shame to waste. So I would be mad at myself if I didn't make it as good as I could and, you know, just maybe bang out an hour and a half of, you know, solid content. I can go into history. I can do politics. I can tell some personal anecdotes. Tonight was just me winging it and really just trying to get a handle on it, you know, get a sense of it. And a lot of stuff is happening behind the scenes. A lot of stuff, believe it or not. There was even a police officer that showed up a while ago, since we've been doing the show, and said that there had been someone knocking on the doors and not, you know, running away or something. And then he parked right next to my car. And then he left. It was like really weird and just sort of intimidating, which is strange. So, you know, that kind of weird, fun stuff happens. And when you do certain shows and things, sometimes maybe you get a little paranoid. But, you know, who knows? I don't know, because I didn't get any feedback. I don't even know if this thing recorded the whole thing. You know, now that I'm in the groove, that groove I was talking about, kind of feel like talking. Definitely not wasting minutes because it's open for like the month, I believe. It's almost wasting minutes to not talk. But going back and forth is kind of wasting them. Let me see if I have anything interesting to wrap up with. I cannot see because I had to move it last minute. Oh, I got all excited because I saw a comment, but it was mine. I talked about E. Michael Jones. I talked about my problems with Joe Rogan. I told the Mike Tyson story. I talked about the Internet of Things. I talked about the Belt and Road. The Belt and Road Initiative. America with the Maritime Empire. And now they want to make the Eurasian landmass into the big land empire by connecting this railroad and road that will, you know, basically connect the whole thing. That's not a small story. That is a big story. And it's sort of my responsibility to bring it up. I talked about the one world religion. That's a real thing. Boy, I don't know what to do here. Maybe I'll just keep. I want to tell the Michael Jordan story, but I want to make sure people are hearing it, and I want to tell it the right way. I'll tell you what, my dad used to tell jokes, and he was from the old school where you told like really long jokes, like it was a big buildup. Almost the buildup was more than the payoff. And that's kind of how you got to tell some of these stories. You have to tease them out, is the expression. You have to sort of set them up the right way, because if you just say it straight out, it just will never have the right impact. Even if I said, hey, the neighbor's burying people in the backyard, you know, it's just not going to have the same weight as if I built up to it like he does in No Country for Old Men, where he says, well, first they found a dog collar. Then they found, you know, so on and so forth, until finally they find a guy that escaped the dungeon they were keeping him in with the dog collar. And they had been, you know, getting these people in and taking their social security checks or whatever. And they were burying them in the backyard and making them eat out of dog bowls was the point. And he said no one had noticed until no one noticed them burying the bodies in the backyard. This is from the movie, not real life. No one noticed until one of the people ran out of the house, and then everybody, it got their attention. And the point in the book or the movie in the story is that he said, it does, in this day and age, it takes like a huge buildup and then that sort of payoff before people even raise an eyebrow to these horribly shocking things. Oh, that's what I didn't talk about. And hopefully this is recorded. I think I did. I prefaced it maybe. About how a society has to have shared morals. I don't think I did talk about this. When they got rid of the obscenity laws, this is kind of what they were going at. Countries need to have objective standards of right and wrong, moral standards. And it used to be not long ago that a lot of people were in agreement about a lot of these things. And they're just not now. And when you can't agree on what's right, what's wrong, what's up, what's down, what's a man, what's a woman, what is a dog, and what is a cat, then how can you agree on anything any more complicated? You can't. So that's by design. It's called social engineering, social cohesion. And they use these models, these behavioral models on everybody. And apparently they work because they never have to go past a certain, they can use the same ones is the point. You know, there are more sophisticated models, but they never really have to go past like the prisoner's dilemma or the shyster's interaction, which is basically somebody trying to sell you something. And that could be a politician, that could be anybody. You know, they can reuse old game theory models over and over and over and over. The other one is, this is a funny story, but I'll truncate it. Somebody took a picture in the Keys. I'm going to send it to Bill. And it was a crazy guy walking down the street, an old man with a white top hat, angel wings, and basically no clothes, and something plugged in his butt. And this guy was there with his kids, and he took the picture. And I said, my God, that's a walking meme. And, God, I got to post the picture somehow. But meme warfare is an actual thing. That's an actual division. So, you know, a picture speaks 1,000 words, and then a meme is like a weaponized version of that. It's an actual weaponized version of that. And they on the cover of Time magazine, when Trump won the election, it said the Great Meme War or something to that effect. That, you know, that was what they were crediting along with Twitter and all that social media for him, how he won. So don't sleep on the memes, and understand that you can express things. And the Masons know this symbolically. Oh. I get a phone call, so I think I'm going to end the episode, guys. Okay, bye-bye. Hello? Hello?